iron thingies.
Shoes?
All those? No, not the shoes, just the clippy part.
Give it a little thing that goes on the shoe.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, the
pants.
Okay.
But yeah.
Great. Mine are not fitting properly.
Yeah.
How easy is
that? Today,
like if, yeah, right? So this is my biggest trade, right? That I'm like,
Joel knows how to change the tire.
I know, but I'm saying, for a new person, so
like changing a tire.
It gets easier the more you do it.
My biggest fear is like being stranded in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. So like, me doing it, I have trouble showing people because I've done it so much. Yeah. There's just kind
two,
of
three, four, five, six. Yeah.
So like, I have to like be mindful.
Just a couple few.
Yeah.
And just
but they're lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was told that this wasn't even supposed to be the way this is. It's supposed to be the College Health Science building.
Yeah.
But what's to say what is it all the time?
Yeah, exactly. It's like the new Todd building.
It literally says it out
loud. Exactly. Don't break that.
Break it.
I already broke it once. I should have made it out of oak or made it out of poplar by accident.
You did. You told me you were going to get oak.
And I glued it. And I broke it last night.
So I'll probably be too terrified to ride it. So
I'll see that. Well, poplar is so soft.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason why I used it to start with, but this actually works when I'm making it out of oak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This could be a very interesting weapon as well when you're done with
short,
it.
But
you know, like,
kind of
sticks or something,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think
it's... So, we're missing three people.
I don't know if they're lost, got washed away in the rain, sleeping in.
Probably
good. Probably good. So, shall we proceed anyway in their absence?
Yeah.
See if they'll show. So, thanks for making it over here to the Wedgington building. I wanted to go over today about the force length property of muscle because it's one of those, there's several properties of muscle that are tossed around like everybody understands them completely. And they're important properties of muscle. And I wanted to make sure.
One more.
Welcome. we're all on the same page as to why the force length property exists in the first place, what it actually is, and for those of you ever going to be in a clinic or working with humans to understand that force length property of muscle, as it was first proposed by Huxley in 1966, is not exactly the same thing you'll measure in a clinic or with a human being. So today we're going to, after we talk a little bit, Emily's going to hop on the side back and we'll record her torque joint angle relationship.
Okay.
Because she's a human, she's torque and joint angle. We can't really measure force with Emily because we have no way of getting to the force of muscle. The best we can do is measure torque with something like a Cyvex or a Biodex, right? So torque joint angle is analogous to force length, but not quite the same.
So Tim, when you're reading a manuscript, and they say that they multiplied force by the length of the lever arm, or I mean they multiplied the torque by the length of the lever arm and got the force of that.
It's a best case assumption. It's an approximation, and it's acceptable. It happens all the time in humans. There's only been about three or four instances that people have measured force directly in humans. Rick Lieber did it in a orthopedic surgery setting by putting a force buckle transducer on a tendon of, I can't remember which tendon it was, the forearm, to get the person to actually get force and look at the sarcomere length. And then Paavo Koumi in Finland did it with the fiber optic wires that you'll have that transmit light through them. He took a, I don't want to guess the gauge, I guess a 10-gauge needle or something very, very large, put it through the Achilles tendon of his subjects, and thread the fiber optic cable through that needle, pull the needle back out. So then the person standing there in their Achilles tendon, they have a wire going through their Achilles tendon. And then had them do different loads, and the wire would bend, and that would change the amount of light that would come through. And he calibrated the light to the load and measured force. Now, after about 5 years, he discovered it didn't work, so he stopped doing it. But those are the only two times I know of that they actually directly measured force in humans.
Welcome to European IRBs.
Yeah. European IRBs also allow you to put bone pins in the scapula to get better.
Yeah.
Those guys.
Maybe we should all move. We should.
So what I want to do is with the initial force-length relationship and what it truly is for a single sarcomere. So I want to make sure that we cover that. Force-length properties, and this picture right here, is for a frog single sarcomere. You'll notice that the length that are listed at the
y, at the x-axis are 1.27, 1.67, 2.25, 3.65. What I hope to do today is give you an understanding of where those numbers come from and what they mean and why they're there. And how we today call this forced length when we apply it to humans. Okay. So, that being said, the force length property is the maximum isometric force that a muscle can exert as a function of its length. Now, this is a definition that came from another textbook. And again, you can do a force length property of a whole muscle. As long as you have a muscle, you can measure force with. We can do it in a laboratory setting. We can do it in ex vivo, in vitro, in vivo, you name it. We have the ability to do that. In humans, it's going to be torque. Okay. But it's the maximum isometric force that a muscle can exert as a function of its length. Now, this all started back in 1894. Who knew? Two, 3 centuries ago, Hans Blix recognized that muscle had, at its shortest length, less force than it had at its mid-length, and then lost force again as it got longer. And even in muscle mechanics, I make sure I emphasize this. This is a static relationship. This does not hold true when muscle moves. It's isometric. Okay? So you put a muscle at a short length and an isometric force. You will relax that muscle, put it to a new length, contract it isometrically, get a new force. And there's a reason why that occurs. And that reason is because of the structure of a sarcomere in your muscle. Does anybody know how long myosin filaments are in muscle? Myosin 2 filaments are in muscle?
Do you remember?
Is it
1.6? 1.6 micrometers. And we say that with a good deal of confidence because everybody's myosin in this room is 1.6 micrometers in length. You know how long it is in a frog? 1.6 micrometers. Elephant?
1.6.
1.6 micrometers. See where we're going with this? Every mammal has a myosin that's 1.6 micrometers. That makes it easy to remember, right? Frogs. What's the fly?
Oh, I don't know.
Huh?
We'll have to see.
Guess 1.6.
I would guess 1.6. You know, it's highly conserved across species. All right. Rabbits, rats, guinea pigs, kangaroos, monkeys, elephants, you name it, 1.6 micrometers. And that makes it repeatable with respect to force-length properties. Right? Every myosin, I made you a myosin. I made you a myosin molecule that scaled 672,000 to 1 in my garage yesterday. That's what I do. And because what I hope to tell you, show you today is that because it's repeatable and because it's expected, because we know how myosin spontaneously polymerizes in a dish, it always organizes itself exactly the same way. So that your myosin and my myosin and your myosin are all exactly the same. The thing that's different in sarcomeres across all species is the length of your actin. Right? So actin lengths are different. Frog actin is 1.025 micrometers length. You don't have to know that. But that's what gives us that force length property right there for a frog. Right? If you look at 3.65 there at the end, right? Look at that number at the bottom of your sarcomere length. At the bottom of your force-length relationship, you'll notice to the far right that there at 3.65 micrometers, how much force is produced?
None.
Zero, right? There's no force produced at 3.65 micrometers. That's because a frog's actin is 1.025 micrometers, and its myosin is 1.6 micrometers. That means this is 1.6 micrometers long. And I have an actin that's 1.025 over here, and an actin that's 1.025 over here. If you add those all up, you get 3.65. That means there is no overlap of thick and thin. That means cross bridges cannot form. Right. That's where all the math comes from in these force-length problems.
That's normalized to rule out passing?
Yep, okay. Just active force only.
Just active. Mm-hmm. So what happens when you take mice and monomers? Let's move forward here for a second. I'll show you this real quick.
Remember Robin Cooper the other day in class said that you throw myosin together, they spontaneously polymerize, right? Myosin loves itself. It will wrap itself around itself till the cows come home, and it will do it in an organized fashion every single time, repeatable and expected. And you can predict it every single time.
Every one of these myosin monomers will polymerize with itself, form dimers and tetramers, etc. But they do it in a way that's expected. So for instance, when they first polymerize, they will orient themselves at 180 degrees from themselves. So the first two will always be 180 degrees.
The second two will do exactly the same thing, but they will rotate themselves 60 degrees and space themselves 14.2 nanometers behind itself. So the second two come in, and they will attach here. Here. Right? So now you have them doing this, right? But they are rotated 60 degrees, but they're 14.2 nanometers behind it. And the second two come in and do exactly the same thing. And they will keep doing this over and over again. Oh, that holding go all the way through. Son of a gun. We'll go on the other end.
Okay.
I might do a press to the drill on the two. Here we go. Actually, came up pretty well.
Yeah, very.
All right. So the first three monomers that actually polymerize will do so rotated 60 degrees and offset 14.2 nanometers behind the previous one every single time, right? And this will repeat itself over and over and over again. It'll repeat itself until it gets to a point where, because these are polarized, the tails will also overlap each other, and it becomes a mirror image of itself on the opposite end. So you have this bare space in the middle. That's just tail. So on any plane, as you go through and down a myosin heavy chain, you'll notice we now have two that are finally in the same plane, right? These two, they're finally in the same plane. The space between those two is 14.2 times 3. Okay, it's 43 nanometers. That is the given distance of a cross bridge that you'll read in a textbook. Cross bridges are 43 nanometers apart from each other. But the important thing to recognize is that's 43 nanometers apart in the same plane. And there are six planes here. Right? There are six different planes that a myosin head can attach to an actin. Right? So now if I have an actin, and I go back to where I was a second ago, which is back to that picture, I'll go to this picture. This is out of Huxley's paper, the original paper that showed force-length relationship in what he assumed to be sarcomeres. And again, it's still a frog muscle, so up here, the very first picture you have up here at the very beginning, you can see this. This is what I just demonstrated a second ago, 3.65 micrometers, right? They have zero force, and you'll see that the myosin and the actin do not overlap. And that's the math that you use, add two actins and one myosin together, you get 3.65.
So if I bring my Z lines inward and I shorten my sarcomere passively, this is not a dynamic shortening, but I make my muscle shorter and my actin now comes in so it contacts one crossbridge in this plane, I now have a little bit of force, right? A very little bit of force. And that very little bit of force is demonstrated right here around A. So the more I shorten the sarcomere and the more overlap I get between actin and myosin, the more crossbridges can contact my actin. Therefore, the more force I can produce. Therefore, as I shorten this thing, more force is being produced, there's more overlap. But it's so repeatable in structure, it's calculable. You can do the math and you can make a lot of predictive equations about force based on how these things are made. Right? So you look at that cross section of a muscle, of a sarcomere, and you'll see six actin, all in planes, rotated at 60 degrees around the myosin that the myosin can come in contact with. Right?
Now, does anybody know what the attachment site distance is on actin? Remember that? About 38 nanometers. Right? So, actin is made up of globular actin. Each G-actin is 5.5 nanometers in diameter. You put seven of those together as a string of pearls, per se, right? You put them side by side. And at 37.5 nanometers, you have a complete rotation of actin. So now you're thinking to yourself, but Tim, you just said that the myosin crossbridges are 43 nanometers apart. Why would the actin attachment sites be only 38 nanometers apart? You ever thinking that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Ken Campbell might know next week. Right. Probably because what we don't want to ever have happen
is all of your crossbridges attaching at the same time. If that happened, and you had this sort of attachment of crossbridges, no crossbridges, your muscles would move like those Roman galley ships back in the day, which everybody rode at the same time. You have this movement, relax, movement, relax, movement, relax. By having attachment sites and crossbridges at different lengths, you have this random attachment of crossbridges. And Dr. Campbell next week will talk about crossbridge attachments, etc. And he will probably talk about the stochastic or random nature of crossbridge attachment and how that works. Right. So when you put this together, and you keep on doing this, you'll notice that as we move along each one of these six planes, where actin lays, each one of the crossbridges will be 43 nanometers apart. And this will go on until you get 100 crossbridges, 103 crossbridges on this side, and 103 crossbridges on this side. And for giggles, we'll just make it 100 because it's better math. So you have 200 crossbridges on a myosin molecule. That's repeatable. It's expected. And therefore, if each one of them produces 6 piconewtons of force, which is thought to be the exact force of a crossbridge, you could say you would have 6 times 200 piconewtons of force, or 1,200 piconewtons of force per myosin, right? That's why it's an expected property of muscle. And that's why people are able to do the math, predictive equations, etc., on how muscle produces force at certain lengths.
You just said there's 200...
Exactly. That's where all the fun comes in. That's where all the biomedical engineers and mathematicians have their way with the random nature of crossbridges, trying to do all the predictive equations of the probability of a crossbridge attaching and not attaching. That's where Huxley's crossbridge paper was 67 pages long, because it was all math. If you want to read that, it's pretty impressive that the guy did that one day as a hoot, just to pass some time. We still use that crossbridge theory today because we still don't really understand exactly how this whole process works, right? But if every single crossbridge attached at the exact same time, you'd have about 1,200 piconewtons of force per myosin.
Now, we know it doesn't happen, and we know that you can increase force, as David said the other day in class. You can take these, you can experience inotropy, which is a sudden increase in force. For whatever reason, there's these pharmacological agents that will help you improve force transduction in muscle. Force. Why? Is it the transmission of force? Is it the production of force? Is it increasing the probability that almost all these guys will attach at the same time? You get a couple extra ones, you increase some force, right? Mechanically, that's how it works. Mechanically, force is additive in a crossbridge. And as a muscle mechanist, it's what we think about all the time is what is it that makes the crossbridges attach? Because can you get more force from a crossbridge? Or can you get more crossbridges to attach with the same force? That's the question. Nobody knows. People argue about it and try to test this. And trying to test a crossbridge that's, you know, this is 672,000 times bigger than it's supposed to be, according to my math in my garage. It might not be accurate. But that being said, imagine if it was 672,000 times smaller and try to measure it, right? So either getting more force from a crossbridge or more crossbridges attaching are really, mechanically, the only two ways to improve your force. We can increase the number of crossbridges by hypertrophying our muscle, right? If you have more myosin in parallel, more crossbridges in parallel producing the same force, you're going to produce more force. Hypertrophy usually results in greater force. But what about those times that you can improve force without hypertrophy? Right, that's the question. And or disease states. Imagine if, you know, we lost a myosin crossbridge. We just reduced the probability of that one ever attaching and producing force. We probably reduced the possibility of producing force the same way we used to before. There are myopathies, and I can't tell you one off the top of my head, but I've seen presentations on such, in which you lose myosin, you lose cross bridges, right? And in doing so, you'll have poorer force production. Right? If you replace myosin with fat, you lose force production. You atrophy, you lose force production, right? But it's all mechanically induced because these guys are the only things producing force in muscle. But the myosin is an amazing thing because it's repeatable, and that's the great thing about this system situation is that you can actually do the calculations and some math, and you can try to come up with ideas as to why that works. Now keep in mind that each side of this thing is opposite of it's a mirror image at the center. These are pulling this way, these are pulling this way, and in doing so, your sarcomere will shorten when you contract, right? There are no cross bridges in the center. That's where the tails overlap. And because of that is why you should always have this plateau of the force-length relationship. Because if I find my myosin again. Because keep in mind, again, the force is a product of the number of cross bridges attached to your myosin, right? And to your actin. So as I shorten and shorten and shorten and shorten and bring this actin in, I get to a point where here. That's the last crossbridge on this plane, right? It's right here. So if I now shorten my sarcomere a little bit more and I bring this actin into here, am I increasing the force production with my actin here than I did compared to here?
No.
No, because there's no crossbridges in here. So there's a plateau of the force-length relationship simply because there's this area where you can move your actin in and out of the overlap zone and the non-overlap zone that's not going to improve your force because it doesn't change the number of cross bridges that are attached to your actin, right? There's nothing here. The next available cross bridge is over here. So I have to move. I have all the space in here. This is a 160 nanometer space in the middle of this crossbridge that you don't have to know that number either. But here it's 4.25 inches. So you can move this in and out without changing the force. Right? And that's why the plateau is there. That plateau will always be 0.32 micrometers in any sarcomere. It doesn't matter because of the structure of the myosin. Right? The thing that changes force-like properties is the length of your actin. Now, if my actin was 10 miles long, I'd have a really wide force-length relationship. My plateau is going to be exactly the same because myosin has the same airspace in the middle. Right? Does that make sense? So if you have to move really slowly, and you don't care about speed and velocity, you become an animal that has a really long actin. Larger mammals usually have larger actins because they don't get to move as fast as small animals do. And then you have things that live underwater, where you can't really go fast underwater. Anybody try to go fast underwater? Like running? Doesn't work. So the longest sarcomeres that I know of belong to some specialized crabs that live far in the ocean that have no need to move fast. They move very slowly, so move out, and they grab things and move back. And their actin can be up to 4 micrometers in length. Yours is about 1.2. So once you get to a point where, if you could, and this has been argued if this is even a possibility, if you could get to a point you had so many sarcomeres in your muscle in series, that when you got to a shortened position, your sarcomeres were very, very shortened, that your actin inadvertently winds up over here in the wrong end of your myosin molecule, right? Winds up over here in a very shortened position. This is 1.6 micrometers in length, right? This winds up all the way over here. This cross bridge is trying to pull it like it's supposed to. What's this one doing?
Pushing.
Just pushing. And that's the argument that's made here for the sudden drop in force.
Notice how this slope of force here is really, really, really steep. There's a lot less force here than there is over here. But the sudden drop in force is because the idea is that these cross bridges are actually pushing and producing force even greater because you've gotten to a point that your actin is on the other side of your myosin molecule. There's interference with the cross bridges on the opposite side that are now pushing because they're trying to pull the opposite side in. It reflects or thinking about it.
I guess, like, the way I always have envisioned it was, like, how a myosin head is aligned that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it could only power stroke in one direction.
Right.
But the way, like, I just conceptualized what you said, it would be, like, well, that myosin head's flipping over to get...
No, it's not flipping over. See, remember, on this side, they're pulling this way. Mm-hmm. And this side, they're pulling this way. So this is what they're doing. So when this thing comes in, it's being pushed by the opposite side. Because there's a polarization to actin and myosin. And so the way they align themselves and the way that they pull and push is based on their polarization. When this thing gets there, the argument is, would it actually be attached to the myosin on this side? And if it does, then it has to be this opposite direction, right? And that was the idea that Huxley put in there. Because these are the data that he achieved. Again, not a single sarcomere, about 500 sarcomeres in series that they did some special calculations to get to this assumption that this is the force length property of a single sarcomere. Right. Unless you actively do a lot of math and do a lot of assumptions and or do a single sarcomere force length, you'll never see the shape of your force length being this way, ever. So when Emily gets on the Cybex over here in a little bit and we do a torque angle, there will be a reason why it doesn't look anything like that, and that's because it's an angle and it's a torque and it's a human, right? And it will be a curve. There will be a less force at short lengths and less force at long lengths and a peak somewhere in the middle, but it won't look like this, right? Because this is for a single sarcomere and a single myosin. At the end of the day, we have millions of those that are all at an average length and an average force producing capacity and average probability of these things attaching. And if you yell at her force will go up.
Yeah.
Isn't that always fun? Studying muscle in humans is a pain in the ass. Travis.
How does like the super relaxing of the big filament kind of play into this where like there's a paper came out in 2015 that said, you know, only 5% of the myosin heads would be activated to do a maximal velocity contraction.
That's interesting.
You know, at zero load.
Yeah. A maximal velocity? Or a maximal velocity?
Yeah. You know, and then there's also a paper that came out just a few months ago talking about, again, the thick filament, how it turns on,
yeah,
and how that varies at length and tension. So say, even though at a longer length, you know, that is only showing that 60% of the myosin heads were activated.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I still leave 40% that could, you know, come
Right. Yeah, and these are a lot of these, Dr. Campbell would have great issues with those. He's more of a theoretical biomechanist than myself, anyway. You know, the probability of attachment of crossbridges is something that's always been perplexing to everybody. So the first question about velocity is, since velocity, so since the velocity of your contraction is basically the additive sum of all these in series, right? Not in parallel. It doesn't matter for velocity's sake if you have all of your sarcomeres engaged or all of your crossbridges attached, because the velocity is going to be a probability of how many of these you have in a series. And V max, say unloaded shortening? That has to be a paper that's obviously in vitro, right? So because you can't do that in humans, unloaded shortening in humans doesn't exist.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Two different crop species.
Because Vmax can never be tested. So I don't know, because it's perplexing because Vmax can never be tested. It can only be extrapolated and then calculated, right? I don't know for sure how to do it then. But I can say that it's likely because of, in some capacity, that the series arrangement and the parallel arrangement are different things. One's velocity and one's force, right?
Based on that super the next day, the probability of cross bridge happening is assuming that myosin and developer two participate in
cross bridge. Right. Yeah.
It's almost like, the availability of myosin in the rate limiting step.
The rate limiting step.
Yeah. Amount of force.
How would they be able to measure that?
Well, just the way that I read it and interpret it, the availability of myosin is a rate limiting step in the force production. And then, so say if it's just not out here free floating,
right,
ready to bind to actin, say it's bound to itself, like the super lactate, suggests, it's not available for production. It's just there attached to itself, not using energy. I don't know.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, the inability of myosin to attach is always going to be a limit to force production, right?
Yeah.
And it never can be that. So I don't know. Ken Campbell, I defer all these to Ken, because he will have a better answer for those.
Yeah.
If he doesn't, then I don't know who would, except Jim Spudich. Maybe.
Are the six planes on the one in parallel with the six planes on the other?
Yes.
Yep. Is there no steric interference with the actin when they cross? Like, and this is just a 2D drawing.
People say that there may be, right?
Because I'm not disagreeing with the push-pull.
Oh, right.
I think that makes way more sense, but I was always taught that there was interference between the actin, overlapping.
I know there could be. There could be. But, and that's probably an argument that people make as to whether or not that actually occurs or not. There's that drop in force, even in single sarcomere studies, the one study that's been done, for some reason at 1.67. Whatever that drop in force is due to is hard to say, but there's some lattice work here. So the myosin actin will go through. It's a matter of what happens to it when it gets on the other side.
They don't bump or push one other, push
they
one
could.
Off.
They obviously could. But in physiologic representation, like in your muscle today, my muscle, and everybody's muscle today, it's very likely that we're never going to be operating at 1.67, right? If you get to a point you have that many sarcomeres in series in your muscle that they're that short functionally, you either have a really long tendon that's getting out of the way, or you really don't have any function at all in tremor muscles. So in a real world, the lack of passive tension would probably remodel your muscle to remove those sarcomeres anyway to get you back out to where you should be, which is probably closer to the plateau. It's hard to say. I don't know if anybody recognizes that even at 1.67 or shorter that we could actually operate our sarcomeres functionally. There's so much less force, right? So a lot of that sort of work about this, and probably part of what you're talking about with Vmax stuff, is a lot of hypothetical theoretical framework of how these things work. But the applicability in vivo is hard to say. What would actually happen.
Well, maybe just talking about the six planes. Do we say that myosin is always in that six planes, or is there some rotation?
Oh, it's always in that six planes. Right? Myosin will always be oriented this way. Now, there's compliance in the systems, right? So we will always polymerize this way all the time. But remember, these things are not stiff and rigid like Huxley thought they were either. They're actually compliant. So the six assumptions five assumptions of Huxley in 1966 are all now known to be not true. But it doesn't mean that the force length property of muscle doesn't exist, because it does, right? It's just that we know that these things are compliant. And we know that we can change the force of a cross bridge
and we can change the number of them attaching. So all those things as well are different, as well as history dependence of muscle. But when you look at it, and it's always in this plane, because it's compliant, does it twist? You know, does it conform? Does it stretch? If it does twist, conform, and stretch, that answers a lot of questions of Pollock's work back in the day, arguing that these things are changing length, right? Some of the changing A-band stuff of Huxley and Niedergierke in the 50s when they said, we think the A-band's changing length, because this is the A-band, right? And if it's not supposed to be shortening, then why did it seem to shorten in those papers? So chances are these things actually do twist and conform some, right, as they pull in. But what that means for probability or kinetics or force reduction, it means a lot of things that I'm not sure, because I don't do that work.
You think the same mice and heads in the same planes always attaching to the same action?
Mm.
Or is there, like, as they're contracting, you know, is there, like, flat rotation? You know, I always thought of it as, like, the Chinese handcuffs.
Right.
You know, you put them in, you pull, yeah. There's always twisting motion.
Yeah, there's been, in the second, remember these things too, each one of these things has two heads, right? So myosin, 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 two heads, two heads, two heads, two heads. So there's also twice as many heads as there are cross bridges themselves. So if you have 200 myosin filaments, you have 400 cross bridges. But each one of these cross bridges has two on it. And still to this very day, the argument of what that second one does, right? And these are free floating in space. You know, there's Brownian motion taking place down here. These things are very close to each other. So can this guy, you know, attach to this actin over here because they are side by side? Maybe. Brunelli's the only paper I know of that said anything about that second head attaching and doing something else. And he mentioned it attaching to the same actin, but during only eccentric contractions. But I'm with you. That thing's there for a reason. The human body is not like to waste things. And keeping all that protein around for nothing makes no sense. So it's doing something. And if it could actually attach to the opposite actin, that'd be kind of cool. Yeah.
Okay, Dr. Campbell hopefully will shed a lot more light on these intricate details and cross-bridge mechanics next week. He's got a really cool model as well.
But he didn't make his in his garage. He made his on his computer.
Does that help? At least get an idea what this thing is and where it comes from?
Shut up already.
Sorry, really. Yeah, so these are in there. I'll put these notes on canvas for you, but this is again for the frog.
This was first done in frog muscle. That's why it's always done in the frog. And those numbers are, if you think about how this thing is made, those numbers should be very accurate, right? Based on your actin, in my sense. Optimal. Optimal overlap of actin and myosin should give you optimal force production isometrically.
Okay. Great questions.
Thanks for chatting.
Ideas. Wish I knew the answers to those. I don't know. There's a lot of interesting work going on at this point in time that there's a conclusive answer to either one of those questions right now.
You've talked a lot about shortening. What about?
I like things fun. Lengthening is fun. There's a paper out just out last year that proposes the new three filament model of muscle contraction. So Huxley's 1957 model of muscle contraction and cross-bridge theory that says the model actually looks just like this. And he actually draws it with the exact same thing because he makes an assumption that force is a probability of cross-bridge attachment and detachment only. And A.B. Hill, same thing for force velocity, that it is all about cross-bridge attachment and detachment. And neither one of those guys, both of which won the Nobel Prize in medicine and physiology, neither one of them could understand eccentric contraction. And it's been a long time getting there. And so what we now know is that there's a giant protein titan that resides in your muscle. And this is, again, from Joseph Rozier's paper. And you'll find a lot of images for titan that are also incorrect. You'll find a lot of times that the titan will be drawn still in the textbook going from the myosin straight over to the Z line. But it has to come down, it anchors itself at the actin, at the Z line as well. So they're always going to anchor themselves together. And that's important for Nishikawa's work. There's two schools of thought on an eccentric contraction. And the first is that as you stretch a sarcomere,
that's being activated with cross-bridge attachment. That as you stretch it, you're going to be stretching cross-bridges, but also going to be stretching Titan as well. Because Titan can shorten itself by possibly winding during sarcomere shortening, with the cross-bridges walking and the actin rotating around the myosin to the point that Titan would actually wind around actin. And if you do simple, like, Hooke's law of F equals KX, you shorten the spring and make it stiffer. Right? And by winding around actin, if that spring shortens, then it gets stiffer. Then when you put a load on that sarcomere, it's not only stretching your cross bridges, it's also stretching that spring. The other school of thought comes from Herzog's group in Canada. And that idea is that Titan has calcium binding domains. And there's some evidence that this Titan molecule, this big, large spring, will bind. Will bind to actin, therefore again shortening the spring. As long as calcium's in the cell, Titan will bind to actin. Then when you stretch it while it's still activated, you will wind up with a stiffer spring and greater force. And that's the argument that you can produce force outside of overlap. Because in single myofibrils, they stretched activated myofibrils to 6 micrometers in length, which is well past actin-myosin interaction, and still had 400 times isometric force. Argument being because Titan is a spring that's being engaged, and that's protecting your sarcomere and your cell. Huxley back in the day argued, and so did A.V. Hill, that, well, eccentric contractions are really weird, and apparently if you activate a muscle and you pull on it, you're ripping these things off. That's what happens. And they go, that's not conducive to function at all, right? So does that happen? Maybe. But what Herzog did show was that if you do not have actin and myosin attached to itself, Titan doesn't work either. So irrespective of whether or not you have Titan, inactivatable Titan, etc., if you don't have myosin and actin attached to itself, you don't get those huge forces from eccentric contractions. So there's some cooperativity of some kind between actin, myosin, and Titan that goes on during an eccentric contraction. So. Does that make sense? Kind of where we're at right now. Those papers are, Nishikawa's paper is really, really good. She has really cool models on the rotation idea, and Herzog's paper is a model that's pretty cool, and they're the calcium binding portion of it.
Could you put those on campus?
I will find those.
Thank you.
At this, that, yep.
They're going to help.
Any other questions so far?
He has piles for.
So, so that's why you'll see sometimes what you'll see,
and this is where it gets confusing too. People put these figures together. You'll sometimes see this figure as a force length relationship, and then you'll see this little line that starts about here and goes up like this, right? That's passive tension. It has nothing to do technically with an isometric force length relationship, except that the passive tension and active tension are additive because they're in parallel. And then sometimes you'll now see the ones that have tension that goes here up like this, and that's the eccentric contraction portion if you pull it from here. So it gets confusing between putting these figures together and to keep adding on eccentric force and passive force. But just remember, this right here is static, not dynamic. This is an isometric contraction at multiple points. It should give you that curve you see here, or something similar.
Oops. Try not to be anxious on your picture. It's the baddest cheeks I've ever seen. It's so cute.
All right, so Emily, what's that? There's no further questions. Let's do a torque to an angle relationship just to demonstrate that. So anyone that ever works clinically can see that you'll get a torque angle.
But don't
worry. Similar, but not really.
Right leg.
Okay.
Okay,
do it.
Yeah, no, right leg's fine.
Okay.
Well, have no ACLs either way.
What's the answer? What did you do to your camera?
I got burned in ACL surgery.
Because you use fire now in ACL surgery.
Yeah.
Fire.
I wasn't talking to you, I'm sorry. It kind of seemed like, I was.
Can you?
I swear.
Give me a strap. A side strap.
Okay.
Do we have it?
Thanks.
Come on. Here you go.
Oh,
yeah.
Pull
this
later.
Huh?
You'll
get awake this way.
Hold that. Take. Yep.
Really push against the pad, right?
I'd rather push against the pad. Which kind of question is that?
The pad hurts too,
It all hurts, but the pad's at least a little bit more comfortable.
Bailey, you're closer, you can see out.
That's fine. You do, so you.
I did it like the same spot.
Thanks for your help, Kirby. Oh, okay. It's really.
Support pain on the shoulder?
No, thanks. What do you want me at? This?
I want you to pad.
This is unlocked.
I know.
Okay.
Supposed to be.
Just checking.
G, M.
Okay.
Sure.
180, sorry.
Thanks.
Okay. Isn't there a strap that we usually strap around?
Flexion.
I'll go over here and put it in the computer.
Is that it?
You got a 60-second rest. So that right there is, so she's she had a long quad length or a short quad length?
Long.
So right now.
Come on.
So at zero.
That was zero, right?
Huh?
Is that zero?
No, this is at
90. Yeah. I know it's 90 now. So it wasn't zero.
When I just did that?
I got it.
Oh, I'm confused about your question.
Okay. All right. Got it covered. For my axis.
There's an entire class just how to learn. So you use this machine every year to when I struggle. We've not taken a class. It's also really old.
Like every Sabbath, school is very old.
The SMRI has a brand new one.
Yeah. Are so expensive. I mean, if it still works.
I know. The SMRI has a brand new Biodex. Yeah. It's amazing.
They have an old one they want to get rid of. I know a department that needs one.
Yeah.
No, I think that there never was one. Now there is.
Yeah.
We should make a baby Biodex for a little while. We did. So Tim did make one of those, yeah. And he was able to eccentrically control their TA with it.
What did I do?
He made a little rabbit Cybex.
A rabbit Cybex and a rat Cybex?
Yeah. We have all kinds of animal Cybexes. No human Cybexes.
What did you drop?
I don't know, it didn't prompt me to go again. Push you.
between the 90 we had a 180. You got 20 newton meters on that one.
Yeah, I don't like that.
That's not good. Wood. So.
I don't know why it's giving us
It's giving me a full minute of rest.
Yeah, but then it turns off.
He clearly doesn't understand that I'm a physical specimen.
Yes.
All jokes.
No, you're not.
I tripped walking in here today. I'm a crowd. So. After I got beat up by an old lady in her umbrella. Spent quite the morning.
You were first in that.
Yeah.
I got wasted and then I worked the next day. But like, yeah, I ran a 10K this morning. And Leslie was like, really? He's like, no, I have to take a shower.
Yeah. It's my life.
I love it.
Kirby, can you come man this so that you can keep walking?
Got it. There
you go.
Hey, you can find
go on now. She's going to give me the number, though, okay?
What?
She's going to give me the number. She's going to give me your maximum readout. That was 37.
Thanks, sorry.
That's better. Thank you. I appreciate you.
So,
37.
What
did you make? It says 34 on the screen. Alright, so my vision sucked. Fixed it for you.
It works on the Y.
No, the angle.
It's definitely not 75 degrees.
I think
yeah, you got.
So I got to fix that one first.
Move it up.
15.
That one.
There we go.
It's still really good.
No.
Closer.
Thanks for your
support.
What
did you get?
What?
What did you get? 65. What number was that? 30 degrees?
Yeah.
65? Okay. Okay.
Is it working?
Yeah.
Going up. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
Are you constructing with every cross bridge imaginable?
No. One's yelling at me.
Bailey, gotta get into it.
Are you watering it? Possible.
Really get in the face.
Oh, found that. It's Erica's birthday.
Who?
Erica.
Ralph?
Yes.
Okay. Remind me that.
I will not remind you of Erica right now.
Hush!
Right, with a little inflection right there.
101. Thanks, Kirk.
There you go.
101. 45 degrees?
Yeah.
All right. Still going up.
Studies on human biotics work. If you yell at people, they perform better units.
Why?
I don't know.
You do too.
Do I?
Yes. Henneman size principle, water unit recruitment, whole thing.
Yeah, but I don't...
Spatial temper.
So how does the psychology of getting yelled at play into that?
Because people, humans are inherently lazy.
That's...
They just are. Remember, you know, the stories of Grandma went out there and picked up the car off her son because Jack fell, that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
You know, Grandma's got those extra motor units that haven't been used yet. There's cross bridges on her tash, and all of a sudden, you get a little adrenaline. Hey, pick up the car. It's true or not, but...
full of adrenaline.
Yeah.
Me?
Epinephrine.
I have some obvious, but...
And caffeine's causes an increase in force, too.
I haven't.
Increased calcification. That's not particular.
Yeah.
That's why we outlawed, like, what, 6 cups of coffee or more is now doping in the
USOC?
Hush,
hush, hush,
hush,
hush, hush.
That's true.
I don't know. I said we give me a number.
Push too hard.
No, I definitely did not break it. And yet one of the postdoc students was doing,
Did it not give no number?
No, it didn't give me a number.
Well, what did the number say as you were doing it? It goes a little fluctuating number.
No, I was not focused. What
was it close to?
Really?
Was it near? Good help, sorry to find.
No, it's where the green line is. I mean, you could extrapolate it from the graph.
Take
about 140
down.
Kelly saw 140, so we'll go with that.
Better what you had.
Nothing.
Nothing.
All right. By the way, this looks a lot better than you did for me in muscle mechanics class, by the way.
Hey, getting better.
Practice.
Don't worry, we have all spring to practice. Done. Turned off.
What was it?
157.
There you go. Look at that. So we stopped at 90. Does that mean you only work on the ascending limb before sense relationship?
No, Tim.
No, you're correct. It does not mean that. But so unfortunately, we can't do anywhere beyond 90 degrees on that side bends because for like it's a table. But if you could do 110 degrees or 120, do you think you'd be stronger? Or do you think you'd it's hard to say, but I think
a little stronger. I think one more degree might be a little bit stronger, but after that, I don't think.
But then you expect it to come down anyway, right?
Yeah.
So this is what you'll see in any, whether it's a rat, rabbit, kangaroo, elephant, human being. You can do in vivo torque joint angle. It will go up and it will come down, but it'll be nice parabolic, right? It'll be curved, but there will be a peak. And it's curved because, again, this is a representation of millions and millions and millions of sarcomeres. All at close to the same length, but not exactly the same length, all working together to produce some force with some cross bridges and some motor units, with connective tissue transmitting the forces, tendons that transmit but also attenuate the forces that make this a much more curved relationship. And that's what you'll see. Can you? And you should be able to measure the adaptations and changes in humans using force length and torque joint angle relationships as well. You get some idea of atrophy, adaptations, that kind of thing. But it's difficult. It takes more calculations and assumptions. But it's there. To be seen. Thanks, Emily.
You're welcome.
Great. You should leave it there for the day. So that's what I wanted to run by today. Give you an idea of... It seems like we always throw around this force length idea. I wanted to give you an idea of where it came from, why it's there, why it's repeatable in some ways, if you have the right equipment and specimens, et cetera. But I think as Travis and Bailey and Davis and other people have mentioned today in class, there's a lot we just don't know still, you know, about this mechanism. I think as we get better science, better equipment, we can see things better, measure things better, we'll get to know a lot more.
They're great.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Well, so Dr. Campbell will be in next week, and hopefully this helps prepare you for what he'll come talk about. He's going to talk about cross bridges and actin, and his models that he has, because he does that for them. Yep. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks.